Hey, Bafangu, you call this coffee? Just so happens, I know a guy. He can get you good coffee and fresh. Hey, I'm talking about Sparkplug Coffee here. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends roast to suit any taste, including decaf, half calf, and your next new favorite. But the best part is that they deliver this exceptional coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. You can order Sparkplug as you need it or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries and never run out of fresh coffee again. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? Start making the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
What you all missed was her doing the hand gestures that are
Yay.
cliche, probably not even true Italian
You
gestures.
call this spaghetti?
There'll be a lot of that on this podcast, I think.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Buongiorno, amici, and so many grazies for dialing up the next 160 project. I think Brad Pitt's Italian accent in Inglourious Basterds was not much worse than Viggo Mortensen's.
Agreed.
We are the Monday Movies podcast that spends 45 minutes to an hour most weeks gabbing about all sorts of classic flicker shows. Our original goal to talk about all 123 filmic greats on the 1998 and 2007 lists of AFI Wonders was accomplished at the end of 2013, so now we just do movies that tickle our curiosity bone, and we spoil them. I'm the guy who lives above Carnegie Hall and is influential enough to get Bobby Kennedy to spring me from jail, Ryan Ellis. And here's the best bullshit artist in the Bronx, my wife, Bevy Lip.
Hey, that's me!
One word, Bevy Lip. All right, well, let's put a timeout on the impressions in this movie, Green Book, because I wanted to talk about Parenthood a little bit. Chris and I often do runs, hits, and errors. This isn't quite that. It's more additions, things I noticed when I was editing the podcast, because I watched some clips and whatnot when I was editing.
Are you going to sing the diarrhea song?
No, although that's another one.
It's been in our
diarrhea
all week.
I think Kevin's doing an impression of some kid from Texas. He does say he learned it at camp, so maybe this kid is from some other state. Diarrhea. When you're sliding in the first and your feeler got his burst. Diarrhea. No, first of all, Taylor Gill's daughter is played by Allison Porter, who went on to play Curly Sue, which was the last movie that John Hughes ever directed. So those who may have said, oh, she's Curly Sue, dummy. There you go. I acknowledge that now. Also, I noticed this watching clips when Justin ruins the play. He's ruining the whole play! That he bites the teacher in charge of the play.
Good, she's asking for it.
Not good. Shouldn't be biting teachers or anyone else.
You're going to spend so much money on shrinks.
And I'm the one in therapy, as Kevin does say at one point. Also, again, Nathan is the one who gives Kevin a ball in the closing sequence at the hospital. Some adult gives him a ball. Purple shirt, I thought, who's got the purple shirt? Rewound to the very beginning of that clip, and you see all the people come out. Everyone's got the kids now, or they're pregnant. The only purple shirt is Rick Moranis. So he's really pitching in with the family now and making sure to bring a ball to the waiting room for his nephew.
I have a feeling that family's going to be all right.
All right. And one final note about the baseball situation is that Kevin's glove changes color between him getting the ball and then using Taylor's doll's head as a ball a few shots later. He's got this brownish glove, and then later on it's more of this reddish-brown glove. Continuity issues. That's another thing we talked about, how Kevin's a pretty good big brother to his sister and brother. Taylor's doll's head falls off. She starts to cry. Kevin sits down, starts using it as a ball, and she laughs. Again, he's trying to make his sister laugh. Anyway, those are the Parenthood additions from last week's podcast. Podcast? We are podcasters. Okay, this begins Controversy Month. In fact, if I just said last week's podcast, of course, Parenthood was 2 weeks ago because we took off last Monday, civic holiday. So last August, 2018, was Movies We Hate Month. But this year we're going to review three films that irked us or other people a great deal. This one irked us and some other people as well. And we released this episode 1 year almost to the day that we covered the Best Picture winner the year before that also irked us quite a bit, The Shape of Water. That was August 13th. This is August 12th. All right, finally, we get back to Green Book. So, the coming attractions trivia for Green Book. Best Picture winner 2018, huh? The real Tony Lip was an actor in several movies. The Godfather, Dog Day Afternoon, Raging Bull. He also was in Sopranos on TV. But also, he was in Goodfellas. He has a line in the tracking shot in Goodfellas where Henry's voiceover introduces us to all the mobsters. What is that line?
If I got this right, it is, "Staying out of trouble?"
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
Not that it's some great line, but you had to identify which one he is.
I wouldn't have recognized him. I had to just look up his character's name, and then, of course, the voiceover, they introduce every single character. So I knew which one he was.
That's what I did, too.
If IMDb.
Not a deep question, but I didn't know he was in this movie until I read that during the trivia prepping for this podcast. All right, Driving Mr. Shirley was screened at many film festivals, including the Toronto International Film Festival, where it won the People's Choice Award. It all started there when it came to winning big awards. Before being released by many companies, including Universal, in mid-November 2018, it made more than triple its budget stateside. People like this movie quite a bit. But Bev, explain the movie for those who may not have seen it, or just remind those who did what it's about with the Green Book. Ayo, skinny! I'm skinny in here!
It's 1962, and Viggo Mortensen is Tony Lip, a rough-and-tumble Italian New Yorker who's hired to be the valet to the very particular, accomplished black pianist Dr. Don Shirley, played by Mahershala Ali, for his two-month tour of the segregated South. Their personalities clash, and the trip has ups and downs, but the journey makes friends of the two men, proving that all it takes for America to solve racism is for every black person to become a rich, well-dressed, multilingual, world-class pianist who stays in the closet and practices the patience of Job, only calling in favors from a Kennedy when he absolutely has to. We're almost there, folks.
This movie solved racism.
It did. Congratulations, racism is over. Actually, it was over in 1962. Who knew?
Where were you in 62, Wolfman Jack? I got thinking about that. American Graffiti set in the same time. So both were documentaries. Well, this is based on reality. That, not so much. That's an amalgam of George Lucas's life when he was young. But those guys were doing something unimportant, although big things were happening. Vietnam was about to start. They're in California, and these guys are in New York and then going through the, what we said, Deep South. Or, in a nutshell, somebody threw an eating contest and a movie about racism broke out. Because Viggo Mortensen, as Tony Lip, is always eating in this movie, and I think I know why his family has to share a bedroom. A detail I didn't notice the first time I saw it, that the kids are sharing a bunk bed in the exact same room where the parents sleep. Maybe because of the eating budget, because Tony never stops eating food. They can't afford to live somewhere else because of their food budget. All right, well, what'd you think of Green Book?
The first time I saw it, it did win me over.
Me too.
I couldn't resist giving in to the charm. Mahershala Ali and Mortensen's performances, I found them so watchable and heartwarming. But this second viewing did not bear it out. Once you remove the veneer of the manipulations, it's just not nearly a good enough film to overcome its flaws. And its flaws are that it is a film about race made by people who have no business making a film about race.
Yeah, mostly white people. Two things I'll say to defend them, because I do agree with you, but two things I'll say for them. One is that Nick Vallelonga, who is now a two-time Oscar winner, is a co-writer and a co-producer of this movie, along with the director, Peter Farrelly. Yes, that Peter Farrelly, for those who may have forgotten. He and his brother Bobby did Dumb and Dumber, There's Something About Mary, Kingpin, all those silly comedies that we liked, but never would have thought about for awards, and now this guy's a two-time Oscar winner, too. But Nick Vallelonga is doing a movie about his dad. That gives it more credence. He could say, "This really happened. I was there." And then Peter Farrelly, the thing I'll say for him as a completely white Northeastern dude, is that he and his brother Bobby often, if not always, in their films, championed the underdog and also had people that weren't typical in movies, in supporting roles usually. They would have a guy in, what was it, Shallow Hal? I forget what the movie was now. But who had to walk on his hands. Something was wrong with him, maybe from birth, and he couldn't use his legs, and it wasn't a big deal. This guy was in the movie, he was really like that. They had characters like that in their movies all along, and Peter's got a little bit more credibility, I think, because of that. He's always been a champion of the underdog, although, then again, is Don Shirley an underdog? He's black, that's the only thing he's really got against. Well, I think he's gay too, isn't he? But that's also hidden. So I'm just saying that this isn't...
You're being very generous.
I'm trying to help them out, because I wasn't a fan either. I basically feel the same way you did, which is watching this a second time, the cloyingness is too much. It's too long. Not that 2 hours and 10 minutes is all that long. But obviously this movie's aping Driving Miss Daisy, which won the Oscar 30 years from now, so 29 years before this one. And I think even more so, the ending especially, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And that's the moment that still made me, not quite as emotional as the first time, but up there, when Dr. Don shows up at the end on a holiday as well, because in Planes, Trains, it's on Thanksgiving, and this, it's on Christmas Eve, and that worked pretty well on me. Except then again, this guy who was so racist only a few months before just willingly hugs this guy. Yes, he's come to like him, but Tony Libb hugging him, maybe that was based on reality, maybe that really happened. Hell, Nick could say he saw that. He would have been in the house or the apartment.
I'm moved by when he lets Tony sleep and he takes over driving, something we
you
never
knew that
see
had to happen.
Do.
That had to happen in a road movie.
I wondered if he didn't even know how to drive, and that's part of the reason why he needed a driver so bad. He let Tony sleep in the back only because he knew how important it was for Tony to get to his family. And of course, we know Don has no family to go home to, so it's a gesture strictly meant to be kind to Tony. Mm-hmm. That I found moving. The idea that Don is so lonely and desperate that he would spend Christmas Day with a room full of people who were calling him the N-word, basically, in Italian.
Don't call him that. Racism solved. They'll never again use a racial epithet because Tony Lip said, don't call him that. It isn't the N-word.
Minutes before he shows up. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They translated it as eggplant, but I looked it up. Everyone's like, it's the N-word in Italian. Mm-hmm. So don't be fooled that it's just some cute racial slur or something not as offensive as the N-word. It's the N-word. So this is what they're calling him, and then he shows up minutes later. And is it because he's a sucker? Is it because he's stupid? Is it because he's desperate? Especially on the second viewing, I found this off-putting. The opposite of heartwarming. It was actually either sad or such a misjudgment. They're just so desperate to let white racists off the hook. They horn this in without addressing what is the interior life of a man that needs to stoop to this level for company.
You're talking about Dr. Don, then?
Yeah.
Okay, I still find the ending to be effective and emotional and touching. One of the reasons why it's nice here, the editing, I guess, well, maybe not the editing so much, but the way they set it up, that the pawn shop guy and his wife come first, because when you hear the knock at the door, you think it's Don Shirley. But it's not, because it's the pawn shop guy. I said, come over, I didn't really mean it. But then, as Tony's about to close the door, he just happens to see Don standing there. So that was a nicely done setup move, I guess, there. And there's even a bit of a laugh when Sebastian Maniscalco, who plays Johnny, is the one who says, when they're all staring at him, completely silent, hey, make some room, get this man a blade! Except he's one of the ones that was a minute ago basically saying, he didn't say it, someone else did. But how was it with, you said eggplant, how was it with that guy? The very end of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles has brought me to tears over and over and over. And this does get close to that, and that's why I still forgive it, because that moved me so much. And that has nothing to do with race, of course. They're all white in that movie pretty well. Probably every single character is, even the side characters. But you're right. Don doesn't know what his family just said, but he knows what Tony has been. So he's going into the lion's den, too. Then again, that's actually a credit to him that he's bothering to do that in the first place.
And he's a man who speaks Italian, so if he spent any time with Italians, he knows probably what they say behind his back, so they would just say it to his face, the same way that they use all that language when the two repairmen are in the apartment early in the film. Tony is so racist that he can't drink from the same glass as the black men who are repairing something in the
kitchen.
Even
if it was washed. Still can't do it.
No.
Just chuck him out.
Throw in the garbage. And it's not like you feel like he's doing it because his friends are racist and he sees it. No, he actually has this expression of disgust.
And he's alone when he does this. They don't see him doing it. This is not for their benefit.
Yeah. Why would you show us
this? They being his family, I mean.
Why would you let the audience see him do something that is this full of contempt? Because that's the only thing that you could have that would make you do something like this.
Well, the obvious answer is because this is a movie that is playing to the cheap seats, and it's this whole sort of arc where he goes from being the kind of guy who needs to, doesn't have to look good to his family, doesn't have to for any other reason other than because he's a racist dick, throw glasses these guys drink, to at the end, in that exact same place, his apartment, he can hug a black man. And that's the arc that this movie's going for. It is cheap and easy. In a year of good racial movies, this is representative for Best Picture of the whole year. Not that it had to be a racial movie that won Best Picture, but if you're going to have it be that way, and we didn't love Black Klansman either, even though that was a better movie than this, I think, overall. Mm. This is more palatable. I don't think I'll watch this again, but I would rather have seen this a second time than Black Klansman. Because as glad as I am that Spike Lee won an Oscar, he shouldn't have won it for that screenplay, but I'm glad he has one regardless of how he got it.
A lot of people disagree with us. Neither of us really loved it, but a lot of people did.
And a lot of people loved this, too. I'll get to all the numbers and the plaudits in a minute after you make this point. Well, anyway, make your point, then we'll get to the plaudits.
This film is like the Norman Rockwellification of race in America. There are these comically surmountable conflicts, and then in no time, these two people who have so little in common find themselves sticking out for one another, becoming friends and spotting themselves, proving that America just might overcome centuries of systemic racism. It's just so criminally digestible. The tagline is, based on a true friendship.
The family disputes that, but then I heard there are recordings where Don Shirley said they were friends. Mahershala Ali apologized for not doing better research. The filmmakers really should be responsible for that more than even him.
Not to say I side with Nick Vallelonga, but his version of the story, he actually seemed quite contrite. Don Shirley was Jamaican, and he was gay. I totally believe that he had a problem with his family, or his family had a problem with him. Even if he was just estranged from his family in the year 1962, that's all that needs to be true. Nick Vallelonga said that he spoke to Don Shirley himself, said that he was interested in telling his story, and he made him promise not to talk to his family about it, to only consult his father, his father's memories, and his own version of the story. Is that true? Is that not true? I don't know. He didn't seem defensive. He seemed genuinely sorry. It's probably a 50-50. 50% he should have done more work. 50% he's telling the truth about his good intentions of just trying to tell the story that's true to Don Shirley.
It's an important point to make, I think, because I just recently heard a podcast about The Deer Hunter, about how it's not accurate they didn't play Russian roulette during the Vietnam War. That's probably true that they didn't, certainly not to this level. My point is, it's not a documentary. This movie is not a documentary. Nick Vallelonga is personally involved, so it's different for him than whoever made The Deer Hunter, because that was based on whatever they may have heard. Nobody was actually in Vietnam involved in that movie that I'm aware of. But when those podcasters got hung up on that whole detail, what seemed like for way too long, but it's not real. It's not supposed to be real, and neither is this, except this does have more responsibility to the truth. But we really should be smarter than to base everything we believe on what we see on the big screen. JFK, to me, feels pretty legitimate, but that's not a documentary either.
There's no film in the world, even documentaries, that are unbiased. Mm-hmm. Encyclopedias have bias. It doesn't matter how little you care about story, there's always going to be something that the author brings to it, whether it's to prioritize certain things or leave out other things. I don't believe for one second Don Shirley ate fried chicken for the first time. In his 40s?
Or learned about black music from a white Italian.
I've never heard of Little Richard.
Well, no, he said he heard of him, or I think it was Little Richard, but didn't know the music and didn't appreciate till Tony played it for him. Probably not true.
That whole, I'm blacker than you. There is such a history of racists using this argument to put down black people. The best comeback I ever heard is, well, I'm black enough for the cops. Which is, of course, true in this film, too.
Yeah, right.
White people don't get to define what black is. I'm a little bothered. I wasn't so much the first time, maybe because I wasn't paying such close attention, but the second time, okay, they've really got to challenge this in some way. The film misses an opportunity to really delve into all the way racists are a-okay with consuming the creative works of black people, eating their food even though they don't want to share a bathroom with them. Considering the very plot of this film, this conflict is very underserved and played for comedy, ignoring the fact that it's like a genuine argument racists make even today.
Chris and I just recently recorded Seabiscuit for Scoring at the Movies, and that movie tries to cram in, as we said, everything that happened in America in that 10 or whatever years. This one broad strokes it, but maybe it's trying to cover too much as well. I don't know. You want to make a movie about race, you think you're going to cover all kinds of different issues. The only reason any of that would work at all is what I'm going to compare to just because it became racial, and that was OJ. I remember when Chris Rock made the joke about how the jurors were taken into OJ's house. That's what he said. I don't know if that's true. That's what I remember hearing.
They showed that in the docudrama and okay, the documentary. Yeah.
So his joke was, if I had this house, I wouldn't kill nobody. And that's what that really was all about. OJ was rich. Yes, he was black, but he was rich. And you can't compare to him if you're not rich. And he was really famous and really rich. So this whole notion that black people feel vindicated by him, I'm not going to begrudge them that, but he's not like you just because you share the same skin color. So it's the same kind of thing with this. Don Shirley lived above Carnegie Hall. He was rich. He was culture. He spoke multiple languages. Tony Lip probably did relate to regular people more often. Regular people tend to be non-whites. Well, he's white too, but I'm just saying that Tony Lip could make that argument, whether it's true or not, that he could fit in with regular people more than this cultured musician who probably didn't mingle with regular people, or maybe anybody. He seemed like he was a solo kind of guy. It isn't necessarily legitimate, but it's not as illegitimate when you think of it in those terms.
If they were trying to make a nuanced argument about class, which actually could be made in this film, then that would be one thing, but they don't handle class really any better than they handle race. Apparently, the real Don Shirley was involved in the civil rights movement, and he had many African-American friends, artists, and activists. And of course, he grew up black in Florida. It seems unlikely he would be more removed from the black American experience than someone who refuses to use the same drinking glass as his black repairman. Which is a detail they put, even though they then show Tony Lip just casually shooting craps with all the black drivers right. outside. It doesn't make sense. It's inconsistent. But, and I think they just want to be like, oh, I've switch flipped in him and now he's fine. That's not redemption. Redemption has to come with contrition. Tony Lip is never sorry. He's never insightful into the problems with the way that he thought before. When he sees the way the cops treat Don, it never really seems to dawn on him that the systemic problems are real and not just imagined.
And he's slugging the cop because of how it affects him as much, if not more, than how it affects Don Shirley. It's true.
For I think an he insult is... that's like deeply racist. He's like, oh, you're Italian. I can't remember exactly what he called him, but
he calls him a slur.
He's like,
too,
you're right? worse than blacks. What? Is he at all changed at the end of the film?
They're saying he is. Clearly.
Well, he's made one black friend. That's the way he's changed. Well, if only every black person could be as composed and perfect. So much of Don's character as it's portrayed in the film is really wrapped up in the way that he has to portray himself. We don't get the deepest look into the way he has this compulsive behavior, compulsively perfect behavior, in contrast with Tony's, of course, total lack of any refinement. It's this odd couple dynamic that drives most of the film's comedy. And that goes to work to shed light on how much work Shirley has to put into his composure and his image. And the toll it takes on him in the form of this loneliness and, of course, an alcohol problem. But what the film never really relays is that Tony's total lack of a veneer is itself a form of privilege. He doesn't have to pretend to be anything but himself. His accent, his crude manners, his terrible writing. He never has to spend one shred of energy making himself a more digestible version of Tony Lip. But that's because being a crass working-class Italian New Yorker doesn't come with any life-threatening consequences the way being a gay black man does. So lucky for Tony, he can just carry on punching out police officers and wiping chicken grease off of his clothes, knowing things will always blow over and there will always be a place in the world for him. But that's a luxury Don absolutely does not have. And he has to work really hard to keep the world from seeing the real him.
So clearly this story should have been told by a black person, or at least should have involved more black people. Octavia Spencer was an executive producer on this movie, though.
I know.
I don't know how much say she had in it. There are a lot of producers involved in this film.
I wonder if she says behind closed doors when she's talking about how the film turned out. It's possible that she was just more optimistic about it. Maybe she's a fan of Don Shirley. I totally believe that.
Hang on. Let's not forget that people are people, and sometimes somebody who's gay or black or Muslim or a woman could be just as blind and just as flat out dumb as any white man is and doesn't get it either. Maybe Octavia Spencer thought this movie was wonderful. If you talk to her in the most private moment, maybe Octavia Spencer would say, I loved it. You don't know. And it's very possible that she's getting into producing now, which is cool if that's the case. Jim Burke, who worked
made a lot of money, so there's that.
She'll do this again. Jim Burke, who worked a lot with Alexander Payne, is one of the producers. One of the writers, Brian Hayes Curry, Vallelonga, of course, Nick, that is, Peter Farrelly, and Charles Wessler. They all got Oscars not that long ago, just earlier this year. All right, so I haven't done the numbers yet. Let's go through the Rotten Tomatoes and the Oscars that actually won and everything else. So the Rotten Tomatoes, 78% of critics like this film, which is not wonderful for a Best Picture winner. 258 fresh, 73 rotten, 7.2 out of 10, and 91% of audiences. That fits with the TIFF thing. It won the People's Choice Award. It's also 127th on the IMDb's 250.
Oh my God, really?
A little bit surprised about that, that it was that high or even on there at all. And it was 36th at the 2018 U.S. box office, made $85 million. Black Panther, a movie that was not really about race per se, but mostly black people, made mostly by black people, was number one. And A Star is Born and Bohemian Rhapsody, fellow Best Picture nominees, were huge hits last year as well. This won Best Picture over those two and many other better choices, along with the screenplay, that's also a debatable one, and Mahershala Ali for supporting actor. That's a fine choice. He'd already won before.
He won that Oscar for a movie about a gay black man mm-hmm. who is aggressively trying to perform heterosexuality.
Yeah, it wasn't him in that movie.
No, he's Moonlight, the father figure. But it's interesting that these films have similar main characters. Main is debatable, I guess, in the case of Green Book. But at any rate, similar themes, one handled with much more grace and honesty.
By black filmmakers as well.
Yes.
Certainly the director was. I have no problem with him winning. The picture and screenplay shouldn't have won those. The only other two nominations he even had were for Viggo as Best Actor. Wow. I love Viggo. But talk about badly cast.
It's embarrassing.
And the editing. The editing's not a bad nominee, I suppose. The supporting actor and editing, but the other three nominees. Never mind winning two of those three nominees. Bad choices. Viggo's been good in so many films, and I'm sure that they thought he was authentic. Nick Vallelonga must have been on the set. He's the producer of the movie, co-writer of the movie. It's his father that the guy's playing, and yet, why didn't you get somebody who's actually Italian? Viggo Mortensen is a big player in the industry, but he's not a superstar. It's not like, let's get De Niro to play this character. Hey, there you go. Robert De Niro could have played this character, I guess. Maybe it would have been better casting. He's Italian.
It's like if someone was making a cartoon version of The Sopranos, they would talk like Tony Lip. He's a caricature of a caricature.
And Viggo is all about doing research into his movies. We just covered him not long ago in A History of Violence. And of course, we did Lord of the Rings many years ago for the Toppenator Project. So we've seen him a few times now. And he was so believable in those roles, especially. But not this one. And I don't really blame him exactly.
50 pounds for it, too.
That's right. Well, he ate and ate and ate beforehand, and he ate and ate and ate during the movie. He's always eating. Apparently, he didn't really ever have catering on the film because he never needed to. This, incidentally, is the fifth film to win Best Picture without getting a Best Director nomination. We must have talked about this recently. I think we did. During the Oscar show we did this year. But Wings, Grand Hotel, Driving Miss Daisy, which obviously is a cousin to this movie, or even a father, and Argo all won Best Picture without being nominated for Best Director, and now this has done the same.
I think it was your trivia question for Driving Miss Daisy.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay. Yeah. And we didn't love Driving Miss Daisy for some of the same reasons. If I had to rewatch a movie over and over again between those two, it would probably be Green Book. But I wouldn't really want to have to rewatch either of them over and over again. So let's set the scene. I guess we kind of did. But it does start in October 1962, and then it ends on Christmas. They shot mostly in Louisiana, a little bit in New York City, just a day or two apparently they shot there to set the scene, and it feels like it's more than that, but then when you're in New York City, mostly they're inside, and they got real snow in Louisiana.
What?
No problem with global warming. Let's talk about the actual title of the movie, though. Apparently the book is The Negro Motorist Green Book, or The Negro Traveler's Green Book, and that existed from 1936 to 1966. That's what I read online. So if that means it ended in 1966, why did it end? I guess, you know what? You could argue civil rights.
Yeah, except that I don't think that eliminated the need for a green book. I don't think that in New Year's Day, 1967, everyone was like, yeah, please stay at our hotel. No consequences. We're definitely not going to give you a hard time. No, by all means, drive around this sunset town. See how that goes for you. I'm quite surprised that it ended in 66.
Maybe because whoever did the Green Book, if it was white people, they might have thought, well, racism solved. But if it wasn't, if it was black people that did the Green Book, you'd think they would realize we still need this.
I bet if we went looking on the internet, we would find that there's still a version of a Green Book for travelers in America.
So the story opens with Tony in the Copacabana. We mentioned Goodfellas earlier, and of course the Copa is a big part of that, at least that one scene. Well, several scenes, I guess, are in the Copa. And Goodfellas. Tony's a bouncer, and then the Copa closes that same night, which is interesting, but then he has no work. That's why he's available to do this, and if it's based on reality, I guess that's true. But what I didn't really fully get, even after two viewings, is two things. Why is the Copa closed? Is that just dumb coincidence? That same night we meet him, and that same night that something big happens when he kicks a guy out of there? Maybe he had to do that all the time. But the bigger deal is that he deliberately takes an influential guy's hat. And the idea is it's gone. He's pissed off at the hat check girl, but then, hey, I found your hat. Here. As if you owe me a favor now.
So I think it's A, to display that he's street smart, because he's certainly not book smart. And I think it probably could just be the touch of Nick always heard this cool story that his dad used to tell about how he curried favor from this guy, and he just wanted to include it in the movie. Although, the way I saw it, is the very first thing we see this guy doing is endangering the employment of his coworker, getting her into trouble, mm-hmm. while catching no flack himself, so that he can curry favor, which we never really... Do we ever see him, like, really
that's, it doesn't pay off.
Cash in? No. Because we see people offer him jobs, but I guess it's supposed to be the mob.
Oh, so, definitely.
Yeah, so he doesn't want to get involved in that. But it doesn't seem to have any connection to the hat guy.
I think both that and then when he talks to the guys later on, when he's on the road, and they want to give him a job. It looks like maybe he's going down there. I'm just going down there to talk to them. And maybe that's all it was going to be in the first place. But I do wonder if he was thinking, well, if I work for these guys, they're going to make me a killer. because that's all they think I am, and I don't want to be a killer.
Yeah, that's what I thought too, but of course we, the audience, already know that these guys are mob affiliates and that Tony's super uncomfortable working for them. He already turned them down before he had any relationship with Don, so it's only Don who's fooled into believing that Tony was doing this out of loyalty. It's a way that the movie, I think, is trying to get around the fact that their entire relationship is transactional. But it fails because we know he doesn't want to work for those guys anyway. Otherwise, he would have taken the job back in the fall.
And wouldn't have been available to work for Don.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the point of that scene, then. If that's the case, then that's more subtle than I would have thought this movie was capable of being. Well, let's talk about the food addiction. Tony Lip is always eating. The real guy looks like he's big enough that he could be eating constantly. And despite Vigo gaining weight, does seem like he's a bit of a poser in this area. I hate to cut on Vigo. I like the guy an awful lot. Seems like a really good dude. But man, he's miscast this role, even though he gained the weight. But anyway, he eats the second sandwich Dolores prepared for Don. I'm saying at that point in the movie, Don wouldn't have eaten that sandwich anyway. You see this name on the sandwich, Dr. Shirley, I think is what it says. He just rips it off and eats it anyway. He's hungry, but he didn't give it to him because they'd had a mild fight before that. There's a lot of reasons for it, and he's still racist, of course. But I think the other issue is that Don would have said, no, thank you.
Oh, I never even thought about
that. Don doesn't really want to eat in the road. One of the reasons why he doesn't eat the fried chicken probably is he's thinking, I'm not really hungry. I don't need to eat 15 times a day. I had breakfast. We'll have lunch. I'll have dinner. That's enough. Yeah, maybe that's why he didn't want the chicken and wouldn't have wanted that sandwich. Of course, the scene where Tony eats the folded pizza, Tony Lip apparently actually ate a pizza folded over like that.
I just can't believe that in reality, a pizza place would deliver a pizza without slicing it. Maybe in the 60s they did.
Yeah, you had to carry your own pizza cutter thing. And apparently Vigo met the Vallelongas, who overfed him in that first meeting, and then he went around the corner and just sat in pain for a long time.
Well, he had to put on weight for the role, so, you know.
That was the beginning.
Yeah.
Also, the Vallelonga family are apparently a big part of the cast in that scene at the end, Christmas Eve dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this whole thing online about how they got in the movie. It was a lie that they were these people, then it was a lie that they were that people, and then it just became that they are authentic. You got to give them that much. I don't know if too many of them have lines, because obviously Sebastian Maniscalco has as many lines as anybody else in that family. We haven't even said Linda Cardellini plays Dolores, Tony's wife. She doesn't have a lot to do in the movie.
Yeah, she's pretty much your typical
supportive wife.
Supportive wife. She's so sweet. She's so warm.
She does have the last line in the film, or last exchange in the film, with Don about thanks for writing the letters.
We never get an explanation for why she is somehow immune to the racism that is in the air that they breathe, apparently. But she's not racist at all. The purpose of her being as perfect as she is because we need to like Tony. And we like him because she loves him. And she seems very happy, and they seem like a very happy family. So we have to assume, okay, well, he must be a good guy deep down, no matter what his actions are betraying.
If this angel loves him.
Right. And she is an angel. It's ridiculous just how perfect she is.
Yeah, it's not impossible for two people that live together in the 60s or even now that one person is racist and the other person is not at all. That can happen, but I don't really buy it too much. Because if you and I didn't see eye to eye politically, we probably wouldn't be sitting here right now.
Well, if you could live with somebody who's that racist, then you're a little racist. You're at least condoning it.
But if either one of them is going to be racist, it has to be the husband, especially in the 60s. It can't be the wife. She can't be the one that's saying things, and he's the one who's quietly accepting it.
You know what, though? It's a thing that gets whitewashed. People like to pretend that women are less racist than men.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of racist
women
in the world.
Which is sexist, really, if you think about it. They can be assholes, too.
Always kinder. Whenever you make these sepia-toned movies about the past, it's always the women who see things, with the exception, I guess, of The Help. Although, of course, it's like very white savory, and it is a woman who saves them. But the biggest villain in that movie is a racist woman.
Better example is The Hateful Eight.
Oh my god, yeah.
Jennifer Jason Leigh is very racist.
Because that's what it's like. Mm-hmm. They're not immune to it. Women are not immune to this. If it's in your culture and it's everywhere, and you have that hate in your heart, you have the hate in your heart.
The first thing we better own up to, social justice warriors or anybody else that wants to see the right thing done in this time and place, is that if we were all transported back to the 60s, all of us white people, we can't claim, nope, I would have been above it. Let's own up to the fact that we may have been the exact same type of people as what we see Tony in this. If not exactly, more like Tony than we maybe are now.
I know. We all like to pretend that we would be the good guy. Part of the reason they keep setting these films in the 60s, in the Jim Crow era, is because they're not really meant to progress anything. They're just there to make every one of us feel more comfortable with our own behavior.
Look how far we've come.
Yeah, we don't want to examine how we might be contributing to the problem today. What we want to see is a villain so extreme that they don't resemble even the worst racists we've personally met, because God forbid we be able to remotely relate to this villainy. How many movies need to have a villain who's a Southern caricature safely removed from us by about 50 years to perform this extreme spitting version of racism when we have plenty of great examples to pick from right here and now? It's just a way to put a distance between the viewer and the problem so they never have to feel icky about it at all.
I guess it's because Tony's talking to Don in their first meeting together that he has a phrase that I think is supposed to be funny anyway, but he says something about how we had a couple of color guys over for drinks last night. Referring to the glasses he threw out. So it's supposed to be funny, I guess. Maybe because he's standing in front of a black guy, he didn't say the word that you know he's thinking, which would have been eggplant or the N-word. So I found that to be a little disingenuous, except that he maybe wouldn't have done it in front of the guy. Did the movie actually have that many people saying the N-word? I can't remember. I should remember. Maybe
did the cops say that?
They must. I don't think Tony ever does, though. Maybe Viggo didn't want to. I read something about how during some press thing for this movie, he said it, but he didn't mean it in a bad way. He didn't intend it that way, and then he caught flack for it, and he apologized for it. I think his point was, he was saying, I'm going to use this word so we know what we're talking about. I remember I used to say that, though, a long time ago. What is the big deal about referring to it?
Yeah, if you're quoting something, if you're just, I get how somebody could not be caught up. Again, like the example you're using. Yes, 10 years ago, you would have been able to use that word when you're talking about that word. But people have changed their mind on that, and not everybody has caught up. You cannot vilify somebody for not necessarily catching up on every single nuance.
And what I've said before on this podcast, and I've said to you more than a few times, is let's stop thinking in the first place. It shouldn't be that you're in a gotcha moment, or that somebody set a recorder in your bathroom in your house or your living room, and they're finding out that whoever is saying racist shit. It should just be that that recorder gets put in your living room, and you maybe don't say the greatest things in the world, but you're not just saying racist, sexist, homophobic stuff. That shouldn't exist anyway. It shouldn't be about, oh, I got caught. Well, don't say it in the first place.
And at this rate, getting a character in a movie to use the N-word is as good as making them a literal Nazi. It's just a shorthand for, this is a bad guy. This is a villain. And unless it's black people using it, and that's different.
And I said, don't say it in the first place. I meant to say, don't think it in the first place. That's where this really, I think, finally gets corrected, if it ever will be. All right, well, we've talked about Driving Miss Daisy being a companion piece, and there is a moment where Tony has to make water. He doesn't say that, but that's what he meant, on the side of the road. And Don's the one who's appalled by that. I think you're the one that brought that up, maybe in our Oscars podcast, but I feel like it was you that said at some point, Don being appalled by that doesn't make sense, because a black man would have had to do that more often than not, especially on the road like they are in this road movie.
In Driving Miss Daisy, Hoak has to say to Miss Daisy, you don't understand all the stops we're making. I am not allowed to use the bathroom, and I am a man, and I have to eventually make water. So that's why he has to pee on the side of the road. Where is Don Shirley using the bathroom then? I'm sure they're stopping at diners where they can eat, and they're using the green book to find places where they can
eat. That's the answer, I guess.
But it's just not as easy as pulling over when nature calls.
It shouldn't be so appalling to him, let's put it that way.
Well, some of his prissiness, I think, is just supposed to be played for comedy.
Plus,
but they must have been intentionally copying that scene in Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah.
I felt like that was an intentional homage to that film, because there's so many similarities, but of course the roles are reversed, because look, it's 2019, and now we're doing this version of it.
And slight acceptance is enough in both movies. Just slight acceptance. Yes. Hero.
Well, they're both movies about how racism can be overcome if you just have one single black friend. And if that black friendship is completely dependent on somebody's livelihood.
Right. Well, then
someone's
again,
bought a friend
Daisy's,
in both of these cases.
Daisy's got the power in her movie. But yeah, it's the only friend she seems to have, especially if she gets to be an old woman. And for Tony, it's his boss and somebody who's got to know well. And as we've made very clear, somebody who he should respect no matter what color they are, because he's so much better than he is. One of the things that's come up so much the last few years with people like Trump is, you think you're better than me? There are so many people out there, no matter who you are, who are better than you. And I'm including myself in that. There are millions of people out there in the world who are better than me. I am so tired of people who tend to be, I'm going to say it, less than you and me when it comes to brain power or whatever else, who have such paranoia about that. Get over yourself. A lot of people are better than you. Don't you want your leader, your boss, the president, the prime minister, whatever, to be better or smarter than you? I do!
Well, it's one thing to have someone be better than you who you might consider to be your equal? What if it's somebody who you might consider to be lesser than because of their race? Although here, I don't think Tony at any point ever feels like Don is better than him. But in the sense that it almost seems like his ego doesn't depend on it. It just kind of seems above it. He's so comfortable in his own skin that I don't even think it really occurs to him. But Don is the one learning from Tony. If there's a paternalism in this movie, it goes the other way around, where he's the one that learns to let loose, learns to eat fried chicken. He embraces...
Have fun playing music.
Yeah.
And the juke joint.
Thank God this white friend was here to teach him how to play black music.
Not teach him how to play it, but to appreciate it.
No, but to appreciate it. There are all these examples of Tony taking care of Shirley, protecting him, helping him recover from a beating, saving him from thugs, sticking up for him with this snooty social club manager.
Well, some of that's his job.
And Shirley never gets to be Tony's hero. He just demonstrates that he's grown to respect him by the end of the film. I think the only way that Tony changes or is enlightened is that he comes to appreciate Shirley's talent for playing the piano.
I think Tony says earlier than you're giving credit for, again, I'm not trying to defend this movie too much, but just to be devil's advocate, I think he says earlier than that, this is the greatest musician in America, the world, whatever. It's not at the very end of the film. So he's realized before that. I guess when he watches Don in Pittsburgh, I think is what it is. He sees him playing. I think it's the same scene where
he's playing.
The first
time he sees him playing, he's transformed his opinion of him based on
look how
on
good
that.
This guy is. Yeah. And that's later on where that pays off, I guess. And you could say that's just a filmmaking technique. And it doesn't have to be kind of sirens going off that he's realizing his boss is not just talented. Tony would have realized the guy was talented if he's going to be sent on the road with him and paid all this kind of money for weeks, months. Clearly the guy has some skills. But then I guess it's supposed to be that that's when he's brought over the light side to realize this. And when they do go to that juke joint, it's pretty nice to see Don actually letting loose and having fun. One of the better scenes, though, is earlier in the movie when they're just sitting down having a drink and just talking about what Don's done in the past. It's a really quiet scene. It's one of my favorite ones in the whole film. But when they do start to bond, maybe the biggest bonding scene in the whole film is when they connect over KFC. And who could blame them, because it is the best of all the fast foods.
Ryan legitimately loves KFC. We live one block away from a KFC. Yeah. Sometimes, honest to God, when the wind is right, I can smell it.
I'm not a McDonald's guy. We just had pizza tonight, but we don't eat pizza that much. I don't eat KFC that much, but it is my weakness, I suppose. And then when Don eats it, so prissily. But I guess that's supposed to be funny. And we didn't laugh that much at this movie either. If this movie was nominated for the Top 100 Comedies Redux, and if it was, it would certainly not make it. But I don't know that it should even be nominated, because they probably think it's funny. It is a comedy director doing a dramedy, Peter Farrelly.
Did you see it in the theaters?
Yeah, if you recall, I saw it the day we recorded our Oscars podcast.
Oh,
my
yeah,
whole thing
that's
was
right, that's right.
Breaking news. I just saw this movie 6 hours ago, and
was
I didn't
it,
even tell
was
you.
Was it a busy theater? Is my question.
No, because the run was pretty much over. That was early February.
Because I saw it in a nearly full theater, and that crowd laughed.
I bet.
When he's eating the chicken, and it's kind of a tension-filled scene in some ways, and especially for an audience that's primed for racism. White guilt is right there on the surface, and we don't like that feeling. It's uncomfortable. So everybody is really dying for a laugh, and they're throwing the chicken bones out the window. He throws the cup out the window, and you see Don's expression, and then the next thing you see is the car stopping, and he backs up to pick it up.
I like that. That was funny.
Got a huge...
I chuckled at
biggest
that.
Biggest laugh, a full-blown laugh line in the theater.
But that's maybe part of the excuse here, too, is this movie is supposed to be something that brings everyone together with laughing. And people who are a parent's age, you said it many times, your mother would love this movie. My parents would probably like this movie if they ever watched it. They probably never will.
My stepmom loved this movie.
There you go.
I think my dad liked it, too. She loved it to the point where we just were kind of uncomfortable talking about it because we didn't want to spoil it for her. I mean, she's like 65. What are we going to say? She's a pretty progressive person.
She's pretty woke.
Yeah,
for someone
who's
retirement age.
They're oddly getting more woke the older they get, those two.
All right, so Don is gay, and that's not blatantly hitting you over the head with it. But, you know, it is true. He does get picked up in Macon, and the YMCA is naked and all that kind of thing. And Tony does his job. You said earlier about how he has to be a savior. Well, it is his job also to watch over Don. He has a gun. That's a scene that's weird because earlier on he pretends to have a gun. And then later on he actually does have a gun.
Hilarious.
Yeah, is that supposed to be that he always had the gun?
It's played for laughs. Do you know who he pulls the gun out for? No one else who threatens Don. Just the two black people who are trying to rob them. That's when he pulls the gun out.
I guess you could argue, and he would probably argue, that he could talk his way out of the situation where they were beating up on him in the bar. And he does do that, except then again, the guy behind the bar has a shotgun. But what can Tony do against that with a handgun? I don't know.
Well, he threatens them with the handgun, and I think he probably would have taken it out in that circumstance, but he didn't have to. And then when Don asks him, do you have a gun, he says no, because he doesn't want him to force to put it away somewhere to get rid of it.
It's funny, if this was a black filmmaker making the movie, they probably would have done that deliberately, as if to say, now he'll pull the gun.
Yeah.
That does lead later on to the homosexual situation. Don's, of course, a black man in the South, but he is subtly gay. He talks about being married, and he said she, but he must have just had a...
Well, you could have married a man in the 50s anyway.
Must have had a beard. But his whole Tears and Rain speech, Blade Runner reference there, where he's not anything enough. That's probably what got him the Oscar. It's a pretty important moment. And I don't recall Tony really having an answer, which is smart. Don't have Tony be the one who has that great answer that says, this is what it is, Doc. What is the answer for somebody who is not black enough, who's not man enough, who's not anything enough, despite his incredible talents, and the fact he's just a human being and a person? That should be enough. And then the racist shit finally comes to a head because they won't let the headliner eat in their dining room, which has always been the case, but finally he's putting his foot down. Makes you wonder if that really happened, especially at the end of the tour. It seems like if that was ever going to happen, it would have been sooner that they would have had enough. Except if you're Don Shirley going down south where you hire a white thug and you have to worry about this Green Book stuff, then either have the patience to put up with it the whole tour or don't go on tour in the first place. So it makes me feel like that was probably not real.
I believe that it happened to him. I believe that he performed in places where he wasn't allowed to be a guest. They would have made that the final conflict just because they needed an ending to the film. It shows growth on Don's part and Tony's part. And of course, this is a great example where the boss villain, you know, they've had a lot of villains that they've dealt with. The worst villains, though, are that snooty Mater D and the cops. And they are both ridiculous, overkill exaggerations of racism from the 60s. Maybe not exaggerations, actually, but just...
Probably pretty real.
But extreme enough in a thing that has been muted now, not like people don't feel these feelings anymore, but it has been muted that people are afraid to say it out loud now so that it's not something we really see in our everyday life. And again, great example of where the worst racism they show is the kind that we are never confronted with now so that it's all very safe and digestible.
We've seen it in so many movies about race, whether it be a slave movie like 12 Years a Slave or something like this. Both won Best Pictures, it turns out. We've seen the yelling and the screaming from somebody who is trying to put down somebody who's black. What feels the most honest to me, either in the slave era or the 60s, and some black people would say that's the same thing, but what feels most real to me would just be this matter of fact, why are you talking back? You're like my dog. You might be less than my dog.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than getting upset and screaming and yelling the way that Michael Fassbender does, and he's great in 12 Years a Slave, no doubt. And he's also drunk a lot of the time, so maybe that's why. And he does have affairs. Yeah, he's an affair with a black woman, so maybe it's different for him. He's a more complex character than we've seen.
It's not an affair either. Don't characterize
Well, so he's raping her. I'm just saying that he's not treating them just as property. He's treating her as a sex object, too. Rape notwithstanding, she is a sex object. And he would probably see it as his lover. I'm just saying that when you look at people who are being blatantly racist, in a lot of ways, especially in the 60s, when it's supposed to be, well, we were before the civil rights movement, but it was, well, it was building, at least. It wasn't signed into law yet. It would have been more matter of fact for a Mater D in the South. It wouldn't have to be that we have a big fight. It's just one of us saying, I'm going to put my shoes on the table in your fancy restaurant. Mm-hmm. Well, no, you're not, sir. This isn't a big yelling match. You're not doing that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it may not be, of course, it's not cool, but that's also what was probably real. And maybe in some ways, it's still real now.
Maybe what would have given it more nuance is if they had found some way to illustrate that Mater D would have lost his job if he had allowed Shirley to eat in that dining room. Each one of those people that had paid money to see Don Shirley play would have been disgusted by the idea of sharing a dining room with him. The Mater D's hands were tied, but they just tied up in a neat little bow and imply that all the racism is coming from this one evil guy. And once you yell at him, then, oh, we're all satisfied, neat little bow. We can move on and have next scene. But the truth is, he didn't really have a choice. He actually would have been in huge trouble if he had caved on that.
Because the system is the villain. It reminds me of a much better movie in 1989 that should have at least been nominated and maybe even should have won Best Picture over, well, Driving Miss Daisy shouldn't have won, period, but Do the Right Thing, or even Glory, but Do the Right Thing is the best choice for that, where you have John Turturro and Spike Lee talking bluntly about who your favorite basketball players and who your favorite singer is and all that stuff, and they're all black guys for the racist John Turturro character. But no, you don't get it. That's different. They're not the N-word. There's something different. That gets at the problem with so many racists, because I'm sure if you were to talk to everybody in that room, they haven't seen Don perform yet, but if they had, and the ones that had seen him on the road before, or if you were to talk baseball, or if you were to talk boxing, they would all say who your favorite is, and maybe not every one of them, but a lot of them would pick a black person as their favorite anything, probably singer too. But you don't see the disconnect. No, that's different. They're not the N-word. That's undoubtedly more common. It's not worse, but undoubtedly more common than the drag the guy behind the truck because he's black, or string him up on a tree because he's black.
for Don to rise above the treatment that other black people receive because he is special, because he is so talented, because he's truly one of the best piano players of his generation.
I think you got something there. Show business pointing out that anybody who's that talented, even if they're not otherwise accepted, are treated specially.
And the price that he pays for that is an extremely lonely life. We see it illustrated over and over again. They are not subtle about this. Don cannot interact with the black people he shares these hotels and motels with, or the black people in the bar. He feels very awkward around them. He doesn't know how to behave when he's around other black people. Is that realistic? I don't know. He's Jamaican and he's from Florida. It seems unlikely that he would be this awkward around other black people, but the movie is trying to illustrate that the price that he pays is very dire. Maybe he would have been a happier person if he wasn't talented and he had just had to operate with other black people.
If we ever cover Whiplash this year, we get to the same point. Does talent actually ruin your life? Mm-hmm. As great as it is to be talented at something and work at it all the time, but does it ruin everything else? And maybe Don in New York didn't really socialize with anybody that much, let alone people that were like the guys and the women, for that matter, in that juke joint where everything's fun. He probably didn't hang around people like that, even in New York,
where it would have been integrated. We see that. The movie doesn't show him having one single real relationship that isn't transactional. I guess his bandmates like him and respect him. Of course, he's also responsible for their livelihood, so they have to be his friend, but they do seem to genuinely respect him and like him, but he doesn't ride in the car with them. He rides in the car with Tony.
Yeah, you could take all of them in the car, I guess. There's room for four people. Maybe you could argue that you don't have room for all the luggage and four people. Maybe that's why. Plus, it could also be that if they can get two cars out of the studio on their trip, then why not take advantage of that? To make this movie, Peter Farrelly and his filmmaking buddies had trouble getting funding, even though they had Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali attached, and Mahershala Ali had just won that first Oscar. That says an awful lot about racial films, and that makes me wonder, I'm not trying to excuse them, I'm just playing devil's advocate with a lot of my arguments in this, because I basically agree with everything you've said. But it makes me wonder if maybe they had to whitewash this even more to get the studios, Universal included, to make this movie at all.
Oh, that's a good point. I never thought of that.
Maybe the first draft was harsher and more true to life. I don't know. Probably not, considering, apart from Octavia Spencer, I don't know if Charles Wessler is black. I didn't look him up, but I know the other people are not. Brian Hayes Curry is an actor, and he's mostly an actor in everything, and he's in this movie. He's the compassionate cop we see on New Year's Eve.
I hate that scene.
Or Christmas Eve, I should say.
So disingenuous. Where are they? New Jersey at that point or something like that? Anyways, they're in the north now, so the cops are nice here. Didn't you know there's no racism once you get over the Mason-Dixon line? That is an embarrassing simplification.
So we've talked about the behind-the-scenes people plenty with Farrelly and his producing partners and writing partners and everything. All those Oscars for those guys. Man. We saw the movie on iTunes. We had to pay for it. We were waiting for it at the library or free on demand. It didn't come that way, and we wanted to do this movie a year after we did Shape of Water, which was also not good enough to win Best Picture, although that was better, I think. The movie is 2.00 to 1 with strange aspect ratio. Cinematographer Sean Porter shot Green Room, good horror film, and 20th Century Women. The editor, Patrick J. Don Vito is his name, pretty new to editing from what I could see, Walk of Shame, and Movie 43. The Farrellys co-directed. This, by the way, is Peter's first movie without his brother. And, of course, first non-comedy. I guess they would say it's comedy-esque, but the dramedy at best, and really it's more of a drama with attempted laughs. And the composer, Chris Bowers, who was Ali's double, because you look at that and think, Mahershala Ali learned to play the piano like that? But no, I don't know how they did it. It must have been digital effects. Chris Bowers was the hands playing the piano. And he's just recently been nominated for an Emmy for the miniseries, I guess, on Netflix that we will watch eventually, When They See Us, about the Central Park Five. Another racial thing. I believe Ava DuVernay did that. So what do you think of the look, the cutting, and the music?
I think in many ways it's unimpeachable in that everyone who did their job did it very well. The cinematography is very pretty, and the pacing is great, and each scene plays out well. The score, of course, it's not my style. It's a very traditional, manipulative score, which I don't really dig. But while I can't find fault with it, I wouldn't say any of it is pushing the envelope or being particularly special or outstanding in any way.
Solid enough. We said Parenthood looked more like a TV sitcom. This is more filmic, I guess. And Sean Porter did a solid job, I think, shooting it especially. The cutting was nominated for the Oscar.
One of the biggest crimes of the Oscar for editing going to Bohemian Rhapsody. Which,
to even be nominated was something.
Dude, I can't even wrap my head around it.
We certainly don't think this should have won Best Picture, and we wouldn't be covering it except it's in Controversy Month because, man, it wasn't shocking it won. I think I even predicted when it had won the screenplay and the supporting actor award and everything else was going to technical stuff. I thought maybe Bohemian Rhapsody had a chance because it won so many. And it was one of those things where it won several in the span of a few commercial breaks. So it's constantly, the Oscar goes to Bohemian Rhapsody. Black Panther was the other one. The Oscar goes to Black Panther. But they were all technicals. Bohemian's technicals were bigger ones, more important ones, like editing. So that's why I thought maybe it was going to win. But when Green Book won two major ones, just like Argo, didn't have the Best Director nomination at all. But Argo had to win things like the editing and for the script, and it did. This had to win things like the script and supporting actor to get Best Picture. Although Spotlight only won the script before it won Best Picture. So we've seen this so much lately where Best Picture, Best Director are split. And the big winner of the night that wins the most, like Bohemian, doesn't win any of the major ones, like Director. It did win Actor, but we see way more splits, more diversified with winners these days.
Yeah, I agree. I'm going to come back to what you were saying before about how if we were alive in the 60s, we would behave very differently. If we were our parents' age, we would have different attitudes. Maybe we do need to lighten up and go easy on people who like the film because it is a really likable film that people who aren't on social justice Twitter like you and I are all the time would just watch and feel good and feel optimistic
it's
about the
step.
Future.
It's a step in the right direction.
It is a good feeling film that has the right sentiment. They let us down in ways that are frustrating, but we can't be that mad at people who just left the theater feeling great and thinking, that's the best movie I saw this year. The first time I saw it, it worked on me. It was fun. It was charming. Mahershala Ali, his charisma in this film is pulling a lot of weight. So it's not like it's hot garbage or obviously offensive. It's just not good enough for something that's trying to tackle the subject matter.
Especially in what was an excellent year for film. Maybe not the ones that got nominated for Best Picture. I liked plenty of them, A Star is Born included. But I wouldn't have had A Star is Born as the best movie of last year. Of the nominees, it was one of the best for sure. And this certainly wasn't. And that's, I guess, what bothers me in that, is that this is the one that was honored. But then, who will think about this in many years? I think Spike Lee's made that point in recent years, that who is remembering Driving Miss Daisy? They're remembering Do the Right Thing.
When we rewatched Driving Miss Daisy, oh my god, I have forgotten it completely. And you watch it now, and you're like, this movie could not have less consequence. It's almost embarrassing that anybody thought it was a great movie, even in the 80s.
But Do the Right Thing, we thought was great, and I can still remember some big scenes from that right now. Okay, last thoughts on Green Book.
Well, if you're a person that really wants to be rewarded for all the views you already hold, rather than being challenged or enlightened in any way, this is the film for you. It's a good film with good intentions, but a borderline embarrassingly retrograde take on race.
Good film is debatable. I'd say 2.5 stars. That 3 I gave it before I think would be knocked down a little bit because it wasn't as effective psychologically and emotionally as it was the first time. The best movies get better that way. When I first saw Planes, Trains, I'm going to compare these two again. I didn't feel that affected by that ending. But maybe because I read Roger Ebert's review about how John Candy really felt more like that character in that movie than we ever realized. I died with that guy. And then at the end, he gets to go home with Steve Martin's family. And it's heartbreaking. Even before that, when Steve Martin realizes that John Candy's wife has been dead the whole time, and he goes back to the train station. John Candy says, I don't have a home. That kills me before the very end of the film. So these two movies have something in common with that, although obviously Mahershala Ali's character in this movie, Don Shirley, has so much more going for him beyond not having anybody special in his life. The way it's painted in this film, maybe that wasn't true. But that movie hits me more, not every single time, but it's hit me more as the years have gone on than it did the first time, and this one hit me less.
I wonder how I would feel about Green Book if it was the same sort of film but just wasn't about race. If you could somehow remove that element, if I would still enjoy it. I made a big fuss about how much I love Hidden Figures a few years ago, which I still think is a really good movie, but because all the manipulation in it is just really basic, predictable, the swell of music. So the second time I saw it, I was super disappointed by it. I didn't like it nearly as much. I think that's what happened with Green Book, too. When you use cheap tricks to manipulate your audience, then the payoff gets less and less. Whereas if you have a story that you manage to tell in a way that is more honest, like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, something where you really are getting more into the meat of what makes people feel this way, then you get the reward of repeat viewings, and each viewing is better than the one before. So yeah, in that way, maybe I go from good to okay movie. It's an okay movie.
Also, when you have to do more deep thinking about it and studying for a podcast like we're doing, we're not just watching this movie without taking notes and giving it some deeper thoughts. We're going to pick it apart more. And a movie like this, you pull one string and the whole thing can come very close to unraveling.
And we are insufferable social justice warriors,
too. I'm not. I've got my issues with those people, too, although I'm basically on their side. My last thoughts on Green Book are, black guys ain't so bad if they got talent.
All they have to be is the best piano player of their generation.
The White Oscar voters want people to think they're woke, but not too woke. Now, before we end this podcast, even though it's been one of the longer ones, I wanted to do this because the whole Roma thing last year, Roma was one of the nominees as well. And it didn't win, probably in part because it was released on Netflix, a little bit in the theaters, but effectively just on Netflix. And that's maybe one of the reasons why people that vote for Oscars said, no, we're still the cinema brand. You ain't winning Best Picture, Roma. I wanted to do this when we covered Green Book, what I'm about to do, because of the whole Roma thing. And Green Book's something I saw on the big screen, but didn't need to. I love Dan Merle of Screen Junkies. He's ranted about this many times, though. The theater experience is better than the home experience. Of course he's intrinsically right about that. Of course it's better. The bigger screen, the better sound, the special feeling of going out. And we've had great experiences going out
to the movies. The lack of distractions for me is actually the number one thing, that you cannot look at your phone.
Well, you can, but you should not. Well, you can do those things, but effectively it's a lot harder to.
But you don't.
Yes, but here are the reasons why, as a 45-year-old man, I have issues with his argument. And he's about 10 years younger than me, so he will maybe learn this one day too. Because I used to go to see about 60 to 80 movies a year on the big screen. But here's why I don't care to do so anymore, and I go to maybe 20. Seeing stuff at home costs less. We bought Can You Ever Forgive Me, the movie that got nominated for Best Actress, Best Supporting Actor, and the screenplay last year, the Melissa McCarthy movie, for less than it would have cost for both of us to see it in the theater, and barely more than it would have cost for one of us to see it in the theater. It was just available that way. I didn't want to own the movie. It was a good movie, but we bought it.
It's the only way we could see it before the Oscar show. That's
well, I think maybe it was still in the theater, but we
couldn't rent it.
Well, anyway.
Yeah.
There's no traffic or parking. Both of those things can be a hassle, and it costs you a lot of money to do that. Beverages and snacks from your own kitchen are way cheaper and way more accessible. You could start the movie, pause it, or even stop it for washroom breaks or wherever else. Yeah, sometimes that can be a negative because you should have the flow of the movie going. But if you really have to take a whiz, I did during Avengers Endgame. I went, I missed a scene, I'll see it eventually. But I had to whiz and I did. You get to cuddle with your wife and with your dogs. Tilly needs me.
He just cuddles with the dogs. It's adorable that you included me.
Well, there's no room for us to cuddle.
You're covered in dogs.
You don't have to wait in line, and you can't be turned away because they've sold out. You won't get stuck up front in one of those theaters that has six or eight rows in the very front there. I've done that once, maybe twice. Anyway, a few times ever in my life, and your neck is craned up for 2 hours, and that sucks. Nobody kicks your seat or distracts with their phone. There's nobody talking. VIP aside, our recliners in the couch are way more comfortable than theater seats are ever going to be. The VIP are pretty good, but my recliner is still better. Our home entertainment system, we don't even have the best one there is. We have a 42-inch TV downstairs and a 46-inch upstairs. But they're not that much worse than the big screen systems, including when we saw Bohemian Rhapsody on the Varsity VIP screen. It wasn't very good at all for what we paid.
No, that's true. It was terrible.
And I'm middle-aged and just prefer to be home to being almost anywhere else. So I love you, Dan Merle, but I do not agree with you anymore. Maybe 10 years ago when I was about your age then, I would have.
We should all see movies in the theater instead of at home, but if movies were available immediately on video on demand, the minute they came out in theaters, I would never go to the movie theater.
I would sometimes, I mean, but not often.
Maybe once in a while, but I think the chief thing that gets me out of the house and going to the movies is the fact that it's the only way I can see a movie that I want to see now. So I'll go to the theater and it'll be absolutely a better experience. But yeah, I'm with you, man. I'm lazy and cheap too.
Bottom line is the bottom line. It costs so much less to see them on home video. And not that many movies are a must-see in that first couple of days or weeks of release. You can wait 3 or 4 months, and a lot of times less, to see them anyway. So, sorry, Dan, but don't agree with you, and those are my reasons why. When we return in 7 days, we'll continue Controversy Month as we dig big into the movie that killed a baby and then, for some reason, couldn't find an audience. But we liked it, and this is the epitome of Controversy Month.
Oh, we are full-blown mother apologists.
Mother! Don't want to blow that microphone out. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for Mother, Mom. From Jared Leto to Hugh Jackman to Mickey Rourke to Natalie Portman to Russell Crowe to Jennifer Lawrence, Darren Aronofsky has never cast his leading actor twice. I don't think they've even been in a cameo role in any of his other movies, but certainly not the leading player. Which of those first people on the call sheet do you think was best in those Aronofsky films?
Who's my favorite Aronofsky lead?
In those particular movies. So Leto and Requiem for a Dream and Mickey Rourke and the Wrestler, Natalie Portman and Black Swan, etc.
All right, so for the
An answer, opinion.
Yeah, for the answer to that, for my opinion and Ryan's opinion, you can check out our next podcast about Mother! Tweet us, let us know what you think, your opinion on what the best Darren Aronofsky lead performance is. And in the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, where all of our over 300 episodes are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made. And many, many more titles on top of that. In exchange for all this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. We are both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. And you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code top100project at checkout. And that's all one word, top100project, and it's not case sensitive.
Okay, well, I'm going to go throw my glass out because... Well, no one touched it that shouldn't have, but let's just throw glasses out. They're so poor they have to share a bedroom with their kids, but you can afford to throw glasses out? I know you're racist, but come on!
And cut.
Bafongo racism! Let me hug the black guy who's got the talent.